This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, members of the Utah-Ukrainian Association discuss the history of the Ukrainian people and how that history led up to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Since the launch of the invasion in late February, Ukraine and Russia have made little progress on ceasefire negotiations. The eastern Donbas region of Ukraine has been especially hard hit, becoming the top focus of Russia's protracted invasion. Negotiations between Ukraine and Russia are underway in Turkey to reach a compromise on exporting more than 20 million tons of grain from the Black Sea port city of Odessa. If this grain is exported, it would mean a major step forward in ensuring food supply lines around the world. Today's panel includes Yulia Holko and Yevgen Kovalov, co-directors of the Utah-Ukrainian Association, and Anya Barashok, president of the Utah-Ukrainian Association. This forum was put on in partnership with the Utah-Ukrainian Association. This forum was recorded on April 20th, 2022. In this first segment, Yulia Holko will provide a look at the history between Russia and Ukraine into the 20th century.
All right. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. My name is Yulia Holko. Thank you, Hinckley Institute, for having us. Like was mentioned before, I am with Utah-Ukrainian Association. It's a local nonprofit that's raising funds in Utah to help Ukraine. And we have been operating since 2015, but we've become a lot more active in the last couple of months, unfortunately not under the best circumstances. But we've been doing everything we can to raise awareness about what's going on in Ukraine and also to raise funds and help Ukraine as much as possible in this difficult time. I have lived in the US since I was 18. My family are immigrants. I have been in Utah for about 11 years now. And so Utah's home, but Ukraine is also home in my heart. So I'll switch over to the history part of the presentation. The parts that I will focus on today are not so fortunate parts of Ukrainian history. It's Holodomor, which is basically translated from Ukrainian as genocide by starvation. And it's also mass deportation of Ukrainians to Siberia, which was done by the Soviet regime in the 1930s to early 1950s. And kind of going back to the history of Ukraine in general, Ukraine, the population that lives on the modern territory of Ukraine have identified as Ukrainians for many centuries, going back to as far as the 9th century to the 12th century, which was the Kievan Rus, the kingdom of the Kievan Rus. And so that's kind of one of the picture, that's the picture that you see right now on the screen, is a famous monument in Kiev, in the capital of Ukraine, by the founders of that city back in the 9th century. And they were the Vikings who came and founded the city. And the history of Ukraine has always been tragic in a way that the nation identified itself as Ukrainians, but that nation had no country that they belonged to for most of its history. And so they always tried to establish that country. However, the strategic geographic location of Ukraine has been such that it's on the crossroads of many trade routes, of many war routes. And so a lot of its neighbors always wanted its territory, and it's kind of been in this never-ending tug of war for many centuries. However, disregarding of any of its neighbors' intention, the most ruthless and dangerous neighbor has always been to the east, and that's Russia. And I will start with almost a century ago, where in the aftermath of World War I and the overthrow of the Russian monarchy in 1917, Ukraine set up a provisional government and has declared itself as an independent nation in January of 1918. That independence lasted a very short period of time. It only lasted for the brief 3 years, and all of those 3 years, Ukraine was fighting back against Russia to hold that independence, and unfortunately, they lost. So for a brief period in the 20th century, there was Ukraine, and then there was no Ukraine again. This should have been 1922, but clearly 2022 is very much on my mind right now with what's going on. But in 1922, the bulk of Ukrainian territory is forcibly incorporated into the Soviet Union. The USSR seizes all surplus agricultural products from the rural population, which resulted in economic collapse. The discontent among farmers forced Lenin at the time to halt their acquisitions and introduce new policies in the 1920s. And so those policies provided greater economic freedom for farms as well as for small businesses. They also loosened up control over, you know, cultural aspects of life. They allowed to have some, certain freedoms as far as Ukrainian language being used in the mass media, in literature, in the government. And it was seen, that short period of time was seen as a Ukrainian revival in the 20s, in the 1920s. And the goal, you know, even though it was good for Ukraine in a way, the ultimate goal was just to increase the support of the local population for the Soviet Union as it was being integrated into the USSR. Unfortunately, that short cultural and economic revival ended very soon in 1928, when Stalin became the leader of the Soviet Union. And his goal was to turn the Soviet Union into the world power, into an industrial and military power. And the way he was going to get there was through selling a lot of grain. And that's what Ukraine was rich in. You know, it was a major grain producer and a booming agricultural nation. And so Stalin quickly put a hold to that. And he also seized all the Ukrainization policies that Lenin introduced. So he completely put a stop to Ukrainian language being used and the culture being identified as such, and the nation, to any national identity that was being briefly reborn at the time. In 1929, the forced collectivization throughout the Ukrainian Soviet Republic brought all labor and land holdings under state control. So collectivization was basically turning individual private farms into collective farms, and where people had to work as laborers on those farms, and everybody was equal. Nobody could be, you know, above other. Nobody could work harder and make a better living and be a successful farmer anymore. So Stalin also launched a campaign to break resistance of the so-called kulaks, and it's translated as a fist in Ukrainian. Kulaks were these successful farmers that were operating the land, that were landowners. They were often leasing the land to others. And so the regime at the time basically identified kulaks as the enemies of the state. That was the class that they decided to eliminate altogether. And so more than half a million farmers and their families were executed, deported to Siberia, or sent to Gulag camps. Uprisings were widespread. I was reading statistics that there were recorded as many as 4,000 uprisings just in that short period of time when the policies were introduced in 1929. And political and intellectual elites are deported during this time, jailed, or disappear altogether. In 1930, thousands of churches in Ukraine are destroyed, priests are arrested, farmers are assigned unrealistically high quotas for grain to be delivered to the state. So basically they were told, you know, you have to meet the quota, and if you don't, you get deported or killed or persecuted in one of many ways. And then feeling threatened by Ukraine's strengthening cultural autonomy, Stalin takes measures to destroy the Ukrainian intellectual and cultural elites to prevent them from seeking independence for Ukraine. So anything that was perceived as a threat to you know, the identity of the Soviet Union as a whole, anything that was perceived as individual nationalist movements was seen as a threat and was basically targeted. Stalin initiated mass-scale political repression, repressions through widespread intimidation, arrests, and imprisonment. Thousands of Ukrainian intellectuals, church leaders, and politicians are executed by the Soviet regime. And this is now leading up into Holodomor, the term that I mentioned earlier. Ukraine's wheat harvest is down compared to prior years in 1931, yet grain quotas are further increased, forcing collective farms and small farmers to hand over even seed grain reserves set aside for planting. So they were basically forced to give everything up, all of their harvest up to the Soviet Union, as well as their seeds. The mass repressions of the early 1930s, along with imposing state control over grain purchases and collectivization, set stage for the total terror. And that total terror was Holodomor. And like I mentioned, it's extermination by hunger. In 1932, famine grips Ukraine. Close to half of the harvest is seized by the Soviet government. And these unattainable grain quotas are imposed, and people begin to starve. A mass starvation of the population begins. Villages that are unable to meet assigned grain collection targets are blacklisted, and they're further blocked from basically getting any food or supplies. And their, you know, any goods are prevented from entering or leaving. 40% of Ukraine's grain is taken by the Soviets. So, you know, you can imagine how if 40% of the food supply was taken away today, you know, how much, what the shortages would be like and what that would cause to a nation. And that's what Ukraine was going through. In 1932, in August, a decree known as the Law of Five Stalks of Grain was introduced, and that's called for 10 years imprisonment or death penalty for taking even a handful, so as many as five grains of stalk, as stalks of grain, sorry, from a field, basically. So when people went out and tried to look for some grains just because they had none, even if a child went out into a field and collected a handful of stalks of grain, a child would be imprisoned or put to death. In December 31, 1932, an internal passport system is introduced to prevent starving farmers from leaving, from moving into other cities or across the borders. So not only were they being forcefully starved, but they were also forced to leave to other places where they could survive. And in January 22, 1933, a secret directive was introduced that closed the borders of, you know, at the time, what was considered as Ukraine, the Ukrainian Soviet Republic. And officials were instructed to prevent any peasants from leaving Ukraine, basically that was further trapping them in their place. When things got really bad in the summer of 1933, that's kind of known as one of the darkest periods in Ukrainian history. If you kind of just Google Holodomor, you will see pictures from this period of time a lot. And there's basically bodies on the streets. I mean, people didn't even have a chance to collect bodies because of how many there were. And like Kharkiv, the big city right now that's been bombed by the Russians, it's scary because the situation is very similar right now. You know, there are bodies on the streets. And it's once again caused by the Russian regime. And at the time, Kharkiv was actually one of the places that was going through a very hard time because of this mass starvation. And so 28,000 deaths per day is a very scary number, obviously. And that's, you know, the historians have recorded the numbers vary, you know, from 3 million to 7 million. Some sources say as many even as 12 million. It's very hard because many of those have not been buried, many have not been identified at the time. And it's, 7 million seems to be the number that many agree on, but that's basically the amount of people that were starved during this period of time, during these two short years in 32 and 33. In August 15th, 1933, they had a census, basically, and the census came short because they starved so many people. And so they were resettling other people into the area to create this fake result in the census. You know, so they were resettling people from Russia and Belarus to the area where Ukrainians have perished. And in 1934, the harvest was significantly worse than in 32 and 33, and people continued to die from starvation. So that's kind of that is Holodomor. It's something that only 18 nations in the world have recognized officially so far as a genocide. Ukraine, has been working very hard for the last several years. Ukrainian diplomats have been working very hard, including here in the U.S., to get that recognized as a genocide. Many states individually have recognized it. The U.S. as a whole has not recognized it yet. We are, participating in different discussions, different forums to try to make that happen still. It is one of the darkest pages of Ukrainian history to date. Another part of the history that I wanted to talk about was the deportations, mass deportations to Siberia. And that was happening in the 1930 to 1952. And one of the biggest groups of people that were deported in Ukraine were kulaks. And those were the successful farmers that I talked about. There were many other groups. The Soviet Union identified many, many people at the time as enemies of the state. And so these farmers and landowners was one. There were many ethnic groups that were being deported, and those included Poles, Balts, so Lithuanians, Latvians, Estonians, Moldovans, Crimean Tatars. There were many, many others. But basically, anytime you were an ethnic minority within the borders of the Soviet Union, it was seen necessary by Stalin to relocate these people, to mix everybody up, to put them in a place where they couldn't necessarily have roots in their national identity, in their tradition, to put them in a place where it was very difficult to survive. A lot of people died during these deportations. Most of the deportations were to Siberia and those very difficult to survive types of regions in Russia. Political and intellectual elites were deported. If you were part of the Ukrainian Communist Party, a lot of them were deported. Many others committed suicide at the time because of what was going on with what Stalin was doing. Intellectual elites, sometimes it was enough to have a university degree to be deported. That's all it took. Industrialists, anybody who owned any plants or factories, members of religious sects, which was basically religious sects was religions. So if you were going to church, you could be punished for that. Members of Ukrainian insurgent army, if you were fighting against this oppression, against the Stalin regime, you would be deported. If you assisted those groups in any ways, I know many histories from my family and friends, and that women would just bring food to some people who were persecuted, and that was enough to be deported as well, or for your family to even be killed. And there were many other groups to be listed, but you'll see on top of that slide that 3 million people were, that was just a quote that I found in the UN HCR website, the UN Refugee Agency. They're saying that 3 million people were rounded up from their homes along the USSR's western borders and dumped thousands of miles away in Siberia and Central Asia. That was the official number, or more or less number that was confirmed, I guess, but in reality, the numbers were probably a lot higher. And So my family, actually, on both sides, on my father's and my mother's sides, fell under a lot of these categories. They were successful farmers, so they were kulaks, according to the Soviet Union, and they had university degrees, and at least one of them was part of the insurgent army, and you know they were religious, they were going to church, so they fell under many of these categories, and both sides of my family were deported to Siberia, and those are the stories I grew up hearing. On my mom's side, my great-grandfather came to the U.S. in the early 1900s in the as an immigrant, and he worked at a factory in Philadelphia. He saved up, and he went back to Ukraine. It was never his plan to immigrate for good. He just wanted to make a living for his family and come back and support them. So that's what he did, and he came back to Ukraine in the 1920s. He bought some land, and he started a farm. He had seven children, and one day in 1938, I believe it was, when the Soviet Union already came to Western Ukraine, because initially it was just in the east and center, the Soviets showed up at their door, and they gave them 15 minutes to get dressed and pack what they could within that time frame, and they were deported to Siberia. They were shoved into overcrowded trains in the middle of the winter. They were taken to Siberia and dropped in the middle of nowhere with everything they had, all their belongings left behind. And shortly after they left, actually, the Soviets burnt their house to make sure they have nothing to come back to. And they spent several years in Siberia. My great-grandfather went out one day to collect a few ears of wheat in a field. It was a tradition, it's still a Ukrainian tradition to put wheat on your table as a decoration during the holidays, and so he went to collect a few stems of wheat, and as he was out in the field, his heart stopped. He never came back, and so he died in Siberia. His wife and their seven children came back without him. They came back to nothing. They had to start from scratch. And that's one of the stories that's been told in my family for many years. And it's been kind of, it's something that my mom would, you know, every time she would see in the news that Russia, you know, there's another pro-Russian decision by the Ukrainian government over the years, or there's another thing that Russia did to oppress Ukraine, she would just sigh and say, I wish grandpa never came back from the U.S. And that was kind of, probably was a big motivator for my family to immigrate again in the early 2000s, and we're here now. So that's kind of my, my family's story as part of, and many Ukrainian stories are like that, you know, with millions that this happened to, many, many families can tell us a very similar story. And it's very sad that what's happening today is very much alike to what happened at that time. And you know, there are even reports in the news about people basically being deported to Russia and even to Siberia. There are these filtration camps that are created in Siberia, and people are deported to those filtration camps. And so the tactics of the Russian regime haven't changed. They're using the same old handbook to do what they've done to Ukrainians for centuries. So that's, with that, I'll pass the word to you again.
That was Julia Holko, co-director of the Utah Ukrainian Association. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Skoma. Today, a panel from the Utah Ukrainian Association discussed the history of Ukraine and its relationship with Russia. In this second segment, Yevgen Kovalov, co-director of the Utah Ukrainian Association, will talk about the modern relationship between Ukraine and Russia.
My name is Evgeny Kovalev, and I'm very grateful for Hinckley Institute to host this event and for those in attendance in person and online. The reason I want to be part of Utah Ukrainians Association here in Utah, and one of the voices of Ukrainians, is that the rhetoric that we're hearing right now from Russia is that does Ukraine have a right to exist? It's an existential question for Ukraine. I know answer for myself, but we do hear this rhetoric from Russia, and we do hear some voices here in the U.S. who kind of support it or justify what is happening in Ukraine. So my presentation will be about the path of Ukraine to its independence and its right to exist. And thank you, Yulia. She really well explained the Ukrainian background, sort of say, and the trouble that Ukrainian and then the sufferings of Ukrainians and the pride that has been paid by Ukraine to be free. When Joseph Stalin was, after Joseph Stalin was allegedly poisoned in 1953 by his comrades of the Communist Party, who was himself were afraid of their safety because he was becoming delusional and was afraid of the exact event that happened to him. So after that, and there was some interim government in Ukraine, and Nikita Khrushchev, Ukrainian-born, became head of the state of the USSR. He retired in 1964, and Leonid Brezhnev, also born in Ukraine, became head of USSR. There are some changes. There are three other head of the government after 1982, when eventually Mikhail Gorbachev in 1985-84, at the time of his assignment, he was he became a head of the state. And one of the things that happened, at least that was during his time, what happened, and we'll talk about it later. He started promoting, at least with the slogans, that government should be more open. People, felt more freedom. It's not exactly the freedom we're experiencing here, but there are some kind of movement towards expression, free expression, other rights, civil rights. What is the USSR? And it's important for the younger generation to know what that was. So USSR, and these are you can see on the screen the words from the Soviet anthem that kind of describes what that was, an unbreakable union of free republics that great Russia has united forever. And there are some irony in these words. You can see free republics that united forever, kind of an oxymoron. But that was the USSR. And you can see here the 15 republics that were part of the USSR, Ukraine one of the republics and Russia another, presumably equal free states, which never actually happened to be, because I was born in the USSR when the USSR broke down, I was 11, so I kind of remember some of the things that happening and the Russian dominance and the kind of killing of Ukrainian culture. in some way. And actually, my last name is evidence of what was happening. So my the root of my last name is Koval, which means blacksmith, and my grandfather had to change it to a Russian version, adding OV Kovalov, which kind of signifies you're Russian and you have like priority in employment and all that kind of thing. So what Gorbachev started was called Perestroika, and called for democracy. They did use words democracy, reforms, and more openings. It didn't happen fast, and there's still kind of I would say during that time, KGB influence was lessened. So what happened, but you know, the Soviet propaganda and the idea of Soviet state and 15 United Republic was still very strong. There are a series of events that happened that led to Ukrainian independence, and you can see them better than me, but one of them is Chernobyl, actually, in 1986, what happened in Ukraine. The big problem was that no one knew. I actually myself was in Mongolia at that time for 2 years. My parents went to work there as builders. But what happened in 1986 was a disaster, tragedy, and people didn't know anything. There were gossips. Some sportsmen were coming back from other countries, and they've been told to foreign journalists or ask what happened, what is Chernobyl, and they didn't know what to say, didn't know what to answer. They were worried, they contacted their families, and the gossips started that something's going on. So that was a big event that the Soviet government started losing trust, people's trust. Then there was a big event in 1989, Baltics hand chain where approximately 2 million people participated and connected Baltic state, and there was some also movement in Georgia where, you know, were some riots and protests and where people expressed the desire to be free from the Soviet Union, and there were some death, including peaceful protests were attacked by Soviet Union in Tbilisi in 1989, and a similar event happened in Lithuania in 1991. There was a coup in Russia that in Moscow that was for about 3 days from August 1920 to August 21 of 1991, and that gave confidence to other republics to make certain moves and to announce the independence. And on August 24, Ukrainian parliament called Verkhovna Rada adopted a resolution of independence of Ukraine. In 1991, there was a referendum, so every person could express the approval or disapproval of the resolution of independence. And this is the act of the independence you can see on your screen. So in December 1991, the referendum happened, where approximately 84% of voters participated with the right to vote. And of those voted, 90.32% voted for approving the resolution. And this is important to know in the light of today's event, where Russia claim, all these areas they voted and under the guns to kind of separate from Ukraine, and this is a map of the votes by region, and you can see Donbas area on the, it should be on your right side, on the east side, there are two areas where Donbass people, more than 80%, voted for approval of Ukrainian independence. You can see Crimea on the bottom, on the south. Crimea itself, there are 54 plus voters, percents of voters approved the independence of Ukraine. And you can see the Sevastopol in Kyiv has a special status in Ukraine. And they, even in Sevastopol, with majority of Russian population, 57% voted for the Ukrainian independence. These are, you can see on your screen, the kind of several facts of recognition of Ukrainian independence, and two of them are particularly important. In 1994, there was a Budapest Memorandum where Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons in exchange for security promises and by Russian Federation, United Kingdom, and the United States. And in 1997, Ukraine and Russia signed an agreement of friendship and partnership, non-discrimination, and recognition of unmovable or immovable borders. So Russia basically recognized the Ukraine and its borders and promised not to attack it. There was also one of the kind of transition into 2004, Orange Revolution, and it was one of the protesters on the streets. What happened in 2004, Russia infiltrated Ukrainian government with its, I would say, supporters or spies, or how you can name them. In 2004, there were massive falsification of election of the president of Ukraine, and people went out on the street, and you can see how many people. It's probably more than a million here at some point, or on the Maidan in Kyiv. And the Supreme Court accepted the case for review, actually ordered a revolt. And after the revolt, pro-European president was elected, the president of Ukraine. And there are a couple interesting facts that people may or may not know. President Yushchenko, who was the pro-European candidate and who became president, he was poisoned allegedly by some Russian spies during the election campaign. And you can see him before and after. There is another interesting fact. Ukraine is an original UN member in 1945. So Ukraine does have a right to exist, and we appreciate your interest in that and everyone who supports Ukraine.
That was Yevgen Kovalov, co-director of the Utah-Ukrainian Association. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Skoma. In this final segment, you'll hear from Anya Barashok, president of the Utah-Ukrainian Association. The panel will also answer questions from the live audience. Here is Anya Barashok.
Hello. So I will just continue a little bit about further history and things that happened in Ukraine. In October 2013, I went to visit Ukraine with my daughter and a friend of mine from here. And I was able to show her different cities of Ukraine, including Dnipro, where I'm from, and Kyiv. She was really impressed by the history and culture of Ukraine, food, museums, just beautiful architecture. And just a few weeks after we left, in November, large-scale protests started in Kyiv, which was later called Revolution of Dignity. 20,000 students joined the protesters from different regions of Ukraine. And young generation wanted to show their support for Ukraine going towards European Union rather than Soviet Union. The whole thing happened as a result of President Yanukovych's sudden decision not to sign a political association and free trade agreement with the European Union, and instead choosing closer ties to Russia. In February of 2013, still earlier on, the Ukrainian parliament approved of finalizing the agreement with the European Union. Russia had put pressure on Ukraine to reject it. The protests continued, and protesters wanted to see President Yanukovych to resign from being a president. Protesters opposed what they saw as widespread government corruption and abuse of power, the influence of oligarchs, police brutality, and violation of human rights in Ukraine. Repressive anti-protest laws fueled further anger. February 2014, clashes in Kyiv between protesters and special riot police resulted in deaths of 108 protesters and 13 police officers. February 18th through 20th was the most severe violence in Ukraine happened. Thousands of protesters advanced toward parliament, led by activists, were fired on by police snipers. On February 21st, an agreement between President Yanukovych and the leaders of parliament, opposition, was signed and called for the formation of an interim unity government, constitutional reforms, and early election. The following day, police withdrew from the central Kyiv, which came under effective control of the protesters. Yanukovych fled the city and country. That day, Ukrainian parliament voted to remove Yanukovych from the office. Yanukovych said that this vote was illegal and possibly coerced, and asked Russian for help. Russia considered the overthrow of Yanukovych to be an illegal coup and did not recognize the temporary government. That time, protests escalated, resulting in Russian military intervention, the annexation of Crimea by Russia, and the creation of the self-proclaimed breakaway states of Donetsk and Lugansk. This sparked the Donbas War that we know has been going on for the last 8 years. just in December of this last year, 2021, again, I was visiting Ukraine. Nothing seemed to be worrisome, and people were just preparing for Christmas and New Year's. I started getting messages from my friends in Utah and the United States asking if I was okay. There was a lot of news about Russian troops gathering at the borders of Ukraine. I was asking my friends and family in Ukraine if they were worried about invasion. And none of them believed that. None of them thought it would ever happen. Everybody believed that Russian army, Russian people, still have some conscience and some common sense, do not attack their so-called brothers and neighbors. On February 24th, Ukraine was invaded, and it changed lives of millions of people. People were forced to leave their homes and moved to Europe and neighboring countries with Ukraine. My family, part of my family, stayed in Ukraine, and some escaped as well. If you turn the picture. So my family in Nikolaev, which was heavily bombed, going from normal life. This is a grandma, she's 85. She's cutting t-shirt to make nets for the army. And they've been sitting in this basement of the school for the last 2 months. And my cousin with her two kids, can you open the next picture, please? They've been there with them, just doing schoolwork. That's kids doing schoolwork and pretty much organizing the space to be their home for now. They hear bombing every day, and when there's quietness, they are afraid that they're the only one left. Yesterday, my family, some of my family came from Ukraine. I'm sorry. It's been a long journey for them. For the last month and a half, they went from one camp to another. First, they went to Czech Republic, then to Germany, then to Spain and France. And they finally were able to go to Mexico and get a parole to cross the border. This is how they slept. Kids were sick and hungry. And this is the reality for many Ukrainians. At the moment, I'm remodeling my house, so I was kind of jokingly told them that maybe after you come to my house, you think refugee camps were better. But they said to me that we just want to feel that we belong somewhere. So in conclusion, I just want to say that it might seem like this is so far away and this problem will never come here, but it can happen to anybody. And if we don't stop the aggression against Ukraine now and all the illegal acts that have been done to Ukraine and Ukrainian population, it will affect the entire world in one way or another. And thank you so much for coming today and letting us speak and share our thoughts with you.
Do you see any parallels between the outbreak of the Second World War and how it took place and what is happening in Ukraine now?
I that's a great question. I think, yeah, there are a lot of parallels. What happened to Poland in 1939, we have a lot of, it's almost identical what's happening. The justifications are the same used by Russia than Hitler used back in 1939. The propaganda, the lack of information inside Russia, the brainstorming, the reaction of the world is very careful. And it's kind of behind what is needed, I would say. It's my personal perspective. So I'd say, yes, there's a lot of similarities.
So I received one from our online viewers. And this person is wondering, what is the best way that we here in Utah can either support you all and your efforts here with Utah Ukrainian Association, or supporting Ukrainians who are experiencing this right now?
Well, we have a website called utahukrainians.org, where you can see all what we're doing and you can donate money there. That's probably the best way right now, because to ship things to Ukraine is extremely difficult. And we found some good organizations on the border or in Ukraine that we've been working with, and we were able to get things fast and safe to where they need it the most. And Yulia can maybe add something to.
Yeah, no, that's the best way. Like Anya said, donations are really highly appreciated. Utah Ukrainian Association is run 100% on volunteer efforts. You know, we all have our jobs, but we also volunteer to do this. And so we don't have any overhead cost. And so 100% of donations go to our trusted, vetted organizations on the ground. And we've sent several shipments successfully since the beginning of the war. So we've established a good process. We have very well documented process, you know, where we get pictures and videos from our partners in Ukraine. And so you guys can see all that. And we post a lot on our Facebook as well. So Anya mentioned the website, utahukrainians.org. If you also look up on Facebook, Utah Ukrainian Association, we post a lot of videos and photos of what's going on. And you can see where exactly your money is going. And just one more thing I would add to that is I would encourage everyone, if you, you know, not everyone can donate necessarily, but if you can spread the word, if you can stay informed, if you kind of, we're trying really hard for this not to become old news, because, you know, it's hard for everyone to see the war on their TVs and their social media all the time. We understand that. But, you know, you have to understand that there are hundreds and thousands of Ukrainians dying every day. There are children that are dying. They're being tortured. There's a mass genocide that's been committed. And so we can't let that become yesterday's news. You know, if you can stay informed, if you can spread the word to your friends, to your networks as much as possible, I think that's also a really good way to help.
And also, we have a volunteer form that we have, like, on our page, I believe, right? And you guys can sign up. And then when we have an opportunity to volunteer or do something at our events, for example, we usually inform people and they can come and help. That's very important for us too. We also need some help with our website and some Facebook, because sometimes we just don't have time to respond to every message. And if we have somebody who can help us that or have some IT background, that will be great as well.
Thank you guys for being here. What would you like to see the United States and kind of the rest of the West do about this problem beyond what they, you know, have already done, which is kind of bare minimum, in my opinion?
I would say that first, it's recognized that Russia support terrorism is state that support terrorism and whatever flows from that, and also kind of be step forward, not step behind, give Ukrainian weapon that it's needs, heavy weapon that it can free occupied areas, not only kind of defend and shrink and do it fast. Without all the bureaucracy that's happening, because there is a real war, and the time is of the essence, and decisions should be made very quickly.
We just add one more quick thing to that. I don't know if you guys have seen from like the last couple of days the news from Mariupol. The situation is becoming very, very dire in that city, and I mean it's just a humanitarian catastrophe. And people have been under siege now for 2 months, basically, and they're out of food, out of water. They have no medicine to treat themselves. And the messages have been kind of, you know, very hard to get out of there because, you know, people don't have internet. Their phones are dead, you know, and Russians are preventing people from communicating also with the external world. But a few messages that came through the last couple of days from some of the soldiers in there, they're basically asking for extractions of civilians and they're asking for extractions of the wounded. And they're like begging the world to do that right now, because otherwise they said days and maybe even hours left. So that's something that the international community really needs to step up with.
That's our show. If you'd like to hear another Hinckley Forum, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.